manhandled by two or three people. You pontificate about a free press. Sir, you pontificate about a free press. You are hurting me. You are hurting me. I am asking questions after being told by Matt Miller that he will not answer my questions until I'm asked.
Please, sir, respect the process. We'll have an opportunity to take questions in a few minutes.
Wasn't the point of May 31st statement to block the ICJ orders? You blocked the ICJ orders.
Please, sir, respect the process. Thank you.
Oh, respect the process. Respect the process. While everybody from Amnesty International, to the ICJ is saying that Israel's doing genocide and extermination, and you're telling me to respect the process. Criminal! Why aren't you in the Hague?
Journalist Sam Husseini was being taken out even before he asked a question. They had gathered around him as Max Blumenthal was taken out. Gideon Levy, if you can respond to journalists breaking the kind of consensus at the State Department and challenging Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State.
I wish there would have been more. I wish there would have been journalists like this in Israel, which you hardly see. Blinken is a typical American liberal, like the Yair Lapids and the Benny Gantz and the Israeli Zionist leftists or the Israeli liberals. They have very clear borders to what should be said and what shouldn't be said. They always say the right things and do exactly the opposite. Blinken cannot break away from his accountability to what is happening in Gaza. Blinken and Biden, they say the most noble things about humanitarian aid, about the right of the Palestinians to live in peace and to have their own rights, beautiful things. In the same time, they finance, they armed this horrible weapon, this horrible war, without putting any conditions to Israel. And they will be judged not according their nice talkings, but according to their policy and their actions. And their actions lead only to one conclusion. What happened in Gaza, which is quite clear already that it is totally criminal, has two main responsible factors. One is obviously the Israeli leadership, and the second one is the American administration. And no beautiful talkings will release Blinken and Biden from their responsibility to 20, 30,000 killed children and babies and women, 50, 60, maybe 70,000 people killed in Gaza, total destruction by American weapons which were delivered to Israel without putting any conditions to Israel. That's the reality. And Max Blumenthal and others try to call the bluff and try to say the truth. And I'm very sorry that their voice is not legitimate.
Mouin Rabbani, your final comment on this ceasefire deal that's being approved by the Israeli government as we speak, the hostage and ceasefire deal, at least for 42 days, what this means for the overall region?
Well, it's not a political agreement, and it's certainly not one that addresses the underlying causes of the crisis that erupted in October of 2023. This is a very limited agreement to deal with a very specific issue, namely a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and an Israeli-Palestinian exchange of captives and hostages. And it's a very fragile one, precisely for the reasons enumerated by Gideon Levy, that I believe Netanyahu will do everything possible with collusion of certain Trump officials to try to scuttle it after the first phase. At the same time, I think the most that can be hoped for at this stage is a return to the U.S. policy of strategic neglect of the question of Palestine. But let's recall that's what got us into this mess in the first place.
Muin Rabbani, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Middle East analyst, co-editor of Jadalia, host of the Connections podcast, and Gideon Levy, award-winning Israeli journalist and member of the editorial board of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, speaking to us from Tel Aviv. Coming up, Trump's billionaire inauguration. Stay with us. Of Gum by Palestinian-Canadian musician Nemesis. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. In the weeks after President-elect Donald Trump's victory in the November election, he posted to Truth Social, quote, "Everybody wants to be my friend," as he was met by a steady stream of billionaires visiting him at his Florida Mar-a-Lago resort, some of whom had kept their distance during his first term, like Meta's Mark Zuckerberg and Amazon's Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post. Now Bezos and Zuckerberg will join Tesla's and SpaceX's Elon Musk, who campaigned with Trump and is the world's richest man, on the dais Monday during Trump's inauguration. They're among the billionaires whose companies pumped a record amount of donations into the Trump-Vance Presidential Inaugural Committee. Apple, Chevron, Citigroup, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Google, Pfizer, Microsoft, and the pharmaceutical lobby also made major donations. Other ultra-millionaires and billionaires attending the inauguration will be those Trump has tapped to serve in his administration, alongside Elon Musk. For more, we're joined by Craig Holman, Public Citizens Capitol Hill lobbyist on ethics, lobbying, and campaign finance rules. His new report is titled "Corporations and Billionaires Funnel Millions into Trump Inauguration Committee." Craig, welcome back to Democracy Now! Give us a lay of the land. What's going to happen on Monday, and who's behind the money for this inauguration, and do we actually know at this point who's pouring in what?
Well, glad to be here. But what we're seeing is the Trump Inaugural Committee shattering all previous records, both in terms of total spending on their inauguration and in the size of donations they're accepting from billionaires and corporations. First of all, the Trump Inaugural Committee set a target of $150 million, which would have broken the previous record of Trump's $107 million in 2017 to raise and spend on the inauguration. Then it went up. The funds just started flowing in to the coffers. And so the target went up to $200 million. And just a couple days ago, the target's increased now to $250 million. We're talking about $250 million to finance basically a party, which is absolutely outrageous. It literally, when you compare it to what other inaugural committees and other presidents have spent on their inaugural festivities, it just puts everybody, it just lays waste to previous norms. Literally from Reagan to Bush, roughly about 20 to 30 million was spent on their inaugural activities. Obama bumped it up to about 50 million. Then Trump stepped in with his first one at $107 million and was largely criticized for that. And now we're talking about $250 million to celebrate the incoming president. What's even more concerning than the total amount being spent is the size of the donations that are coming in from corporations and billionaires all of whom, just about all of whom, want something from the Trump administration. You know, we're taking a look at cryptocurrency. The cryptocurrency industry just came out of the woodwork. I mean, they hardly ever contributed to politics at all until 2020. And now they're pumping millions and millions and millions into the inauguration.
And Trump says he's going to issue an executive order on cryptocurrency on day one.
That's absolutely right. I mean, when you talk about what does this buy? I mean, you got Ripple, Coinbase, MoonPay, all these cryptocurrency businesses investing heavily in the inauguration. And Trump just recently announced that he's going to issue an executive order giving priority consideration to cryptocurrency. That means that federal agencies are going to have to take into consideration and figure out how to work with cryptocurrency. This is a dream come true. And, you know, prior to all this money coming in from the cryptocurrency industry, Trump was not a big defender of cryptocurrency. But suddenly he's in their laps at this point.
So maybe I don't have a big enough imagination, but how do you spend $250 million on a party? I mean, what are the rules and regulations, and where does this money go? It's not going to all go into Inauguration Day. Who gets it?
You know, we're not going to know in the end where much of that money goes. The rules for regulating inaugural fundraising activities are very, very minimal. There's only two rules of relevance. One is that a foreign national cannot contribute. Everyone else can. Every corporation, government contractor, billionaire, they can all give as much as they want. There's no limit on how much they can give. And the second rule is 90 days after the inauguration, the inaugural committee will release a record of donors of $200 or more to the inauguration. Now, that's just donors only. The disclosure records will not tell us how the money was spent, and so we're not going to know that. There's also no rules in effect as to how surplus funds are allocated. You know, at $250 million, it isn't possible that the Trump inaugural committee can spend that much. Even back in 2017 with $107 million, they had a surplus with that. And I had written letters twice to the inaugural committee asking what's going on with the surplus funds and never got an answer. They don't have to answer me. They don't have to tell us what they're going to do with the funds. The stories we're hearing in the press at this point is that some of the surplus may go to Trump's super PAC. Some may go to the presidential library. But in the end, we really don't know. If they don't want to tell us where that money goes, we're not going to know.
So I want to ask you about the inaugural fund chairs. You've got the well-known millionaire, former Georgia Senator Kelly Loeffler, who's Trump's pick to be the head of the Small Business Administration, and a man who's very much been in the news over the last weeks, the real estate investor Steve Witkoff, who is the one who pressured Netanyahu to accept the ceasefire deal.
Yes, what we're seeing is the Trump nominees for all the various cabinet posts and senior positions tend to be his biggest donors. We see like Linda McMahon and Luckin, who were the head of the transition team, are being appointed as secretaries, cabinet officials. Elon Musk has worked himself into an advisory role, but Trump is even giving him an office in the White House. And by the way, I want to emphasize, in the advisory capacity, then Elon Musk no longer has to comply with strict ethics rules. So even though he has to disclose any conflicts of interest, he does not have to recuse himself from serious conflicts of interest or divest, which is an ideal. ideal position for Elon Musk. I mean, that way he gets
because,
to hang on to his
Craig,
money.
Why doesn't he have to reveal? You're talking about him and Vivek Ramaswamy heading up Doge, right? The office on government efficiency, but it's not actually a real government office.
There's the code of ethics for an advisory position is very minimal. Now, Elon Musk does have to disclose his conflicts of interest, but he doesn't have to work out an arrangement to recuse himself from those conflicts if he can justify that the conflicts affect more than just him. If it goes beyond him to affect the whole industry like cryptocurrency, then it's fine. He doesn't have to recuse himself. He doesn't have to divest.
We just have a few minutes, and I want to get to a number of issues. One is you have proposed dealing with abuses of inaugural fund, you know, where that hundreds of millions of dollars will actually go, with a legit bill called the Inaugural Fund Integrity Act. 20 seconds on what that is.
That's right. The bill was just introduced yesterday by Representative Scanlon in the House, and I am working to try to find a Senate companion for the bill as well. That bill would actually bring together some reasonable regulations on the inaugural financing. You know, inaugural financing has always been sort of an unregulated field, largely because no one really suspected it would become a playground for billionaires and government contractors to try to curry favor. What we're seeing this time around at $250 million, with all these special interests giving $1 million or more, that this is exactly what's going on. They are buying access and with the hope of buying influence and public policies and government contracts. So now that we're seeing the abuses that are just phenomenal this time around, I'm hoping this legislation stands a good chance. It would set up, first of all, a ban on corporations making contributions, and that includes government contractors. It would set a contribution limit on individuals at $50,000. Which is perfectly reasonable, even though, in my mind, kind of high, but at least it's better than $1 million or $5 million that we're seeing now. And it would require full disclosure of both expenditures and contributions to the inaugural committee. And it would set up rules as to how the surplus funds are dispensed. Surplus funds would have to be given to a legitimate nonprofit organization and cannot be used for personal benefit. So it's legislation that's needed. It's been introduced several times and hasn't gone very far. But with this record-breaking Trump inauguration, I suspect we're going to get some legs behind this legislation this time around. I mean, this inauguration and the massive donors.
20 seconds.
You know, the executive order for the cryptocurrency industry just, you know, reflects that they are buying influence with the Trump administration. So we're going to see scandal after scandal follow this inauguration. And reform often comes on the heels of scandal.
Craig Holman, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll continue to follow this story. Public Citizens Capitol Hill lobbyist on ethics, lobbying, and campaign finance rules. We'll link to your report. Corporations and billionaires funnel millions into Trump Inauguration Committee. Next up, President Biden has made history granting thousands of commutations, pardons, clemency. Will he grant clemency to the Native American leader Leonard Peltier, imprisoned for half a century? Stay with us. Julie Cruise from the Twin Peaks soundtrack. Iconoclastic director, transcendental meditation evangelist David Lynch passed away Thursday at the age of 78. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. There are just days left in President Biden's term. He has made history today, granting thousands of commutations, clemency overall, pardons in his last weeks. The question is, will he grant clemency to Leonard Peltier? Over 120 tribal leaders are calling on Biden to grant the indigenous leader, Leonard Peltier, clemency as one of his final acts in office. In a letter to Biden, the tribal leaders write, quote, "Our standing in the world as a champion of freedom, justice, and human rights cannot be maintained in a system that allows Leonard Peltier to die in prison." Leonard Peltier recently turned 80 years old. He spent a majority of his life, nearly half a century, in prison. For decades, he and his supporters have maintained Peltier's innocence over the 1975 killing of two FBI agents in a shootout on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, and say his conviction was riddled with irregularities and prosecutorial misconduct. Federal government has been repeatedly accused of failing to prove its case against Peltier. The former U.S. attorney, James Reynolds, who was a federal prosecutor for the District of South Dakota and was involved in Peltier's prosecution, wrote to President Biden in 2021 advocating for Peltier's release. This is Reynolds reading a portion of that letter in a recent video produced by Preston Randolph.
President Joe Biden, I write today from a position rare for a former prosecutor to beseech you to commute the sentence of a man who I helped to put behind bars. Leonard Peltier's conviction and continued incarceration is a testament in a time and system of justice that is no longer has a place in our society. We were not able to prove that Mr. Peltier personally committed any offense on the reservation. As a result, Mr. Peltier's conviction now rests is that he was guilty of a murder simply because he was present on the reservation that day. He had served time for more than 46 years on the hands of minimal evidence, a result I strongly doubt would be upheld in any court today. I believe that a grant of executive clemency would serve the best interest of justice and the best interest of our country.
For more, we go to Rapid City, South Dakota, where we're joined by Nick Tilson, founder and CEO of NDN Collective. Tilson is among the more than 120 tribal leaders who issued a letter to Biden earlier this month as they continue to plead for Peltier's freedom, who's imprisoned in Florida right now. Nick Tilson, we only have a few minutes. Have you met with the pardon board?
We actually met with the pardon attorney. Liz Oyer, we met with the pardon attorney at the Department of Justice headquarters in December with tribal leaders from around the country, and talked specifically about Leonard Peltier and what this would mean for Indian country. And she was the one who was actually drafting the recommendation, because there will be a recommendation that goes from the Department of Justice to the president's desk. And now that recommendation has been made, and is sitting on the press on the desk of the president right now. And he will make a decision in, you know, today or tomorrow, in the coming days, whether he's going to grant clemency to Leonard Peltier. And we don't know exactly what the recommendation is. But when we left that meeting, all of the tribal leaders, we felt like she was going to bring justice to Leonard Peltier, and we felt like it was going to be a recommendation for his release. And then the decision lies on the president.
So what did the pardon attorney tell you?
The pardon attorney told us that they knew the case inside and out, that one of the primary focuses of this particular meeting that we were sitting in is that the section of the recommendation that she wanted to work on was what this would mean for Indian country. What this would mean for Indian country if Leonard Peltier was released. And we talked in depth that the president of the United States issued an apology for the boarding schools. And that it so happens to be that America's longest incarcerated indigenous political prisoner in history is, in fact, a boarding school survivor, and that we need to see action from the president, and that this is also an issue that will help illuminate many of the other good things that the Biden administration has done for Indian people. And so that, and so, she confirmed that in fact there was for sure going to be a written recommendation, and it was going to for sure go on to the president of the United States, and he was going to make a decision before he leaves office.
What is Leonard Peltier's condition in the Florida prison?
Leonard is 80% blind in one eye. He has type 2 diabetes. He's in a walker. He has an aortic aneurysm. His health is deteriorating, and that facility, quite frankly, doesn't even have the capability to meet his medical needs. And so it's absolutely a dire situation, and we need to get Leonard out of that prison, back home, and able to see a doctor almost immediately upon his release.
Can you tell me if the first ever U.S. cabinet, Native American cabinet member, Deb Haaland, the former Congress member from New Mexico, has weighed in?
She has weighed in directly to the president. On Air Force One from Washington, D.C. to Arizona, when the announcement was going to be made for the apology for the boarding schools, she weighed in then. She's weighed in several times. And at this point in time, the president of the United States needs to listen to this matriarch and needs to listen to Secretary Deb Haaland. And because this is a priority for Indian country, and this is a perfect opportunity for the president of the United States to listen to the Honorable Secretary Haaland. And she has weighed in. She has not weighed in publicly, but she has weighed in directly to the president as the Secretary of the Department of Interior.
I wanted to play a clip from, it was over 10 years ago when I talked to Leonard Peltier in prison on the phone at the time. It was President Obama who was in office. Leonard, this is Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! I was
wondering. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. I was wondering if you have a message for President Obama.
I just hope he can, stop the wars that are going on in the world and stop killing all those people getting killed and, give the Black Hills back to my people and turn me loose.
I thought it was very interesting, Nick Tilson, as we break away from that interview, people can hear the whole interview at democracynow.org, that when I asked him to comment, he didn't comment first on his own case. He talked about stopping the wars. If you can, in this last 30 seconds that we have, talk about what it would mean for Native America, for Indian country, for this country overall, for Leonard Peltier to be granted clemency.
All throughout the history of the treatment of Indian people by the United States government, it has been one of injustice. And the reality is how Leonard Peltier was treated in his prosecution and incarceration is consistent with how this country has treated Indian people. And that's why all of us see a little bit of ourselves in Leonard Peltier. And that's why we fight so hard for him. So this is about Leonard's freedom, but this is about justice for Indian people everywhere. This is about human rights for people everywhere. This is about paving a path forward that gives us the opportunity to have justice and begin to heal the relationship between the United States government and Indian people. And so this decision is massive. And I really hope that the president of the United States weighs this decision. If he releases Leonard Peltier, he will be forever known the president who did that.
Native American activist Nick Tilson, we're going to leave it there. Founder and CEO of NDN Collective, thank you so much. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Anjali Kamat, Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman.
If you're a Canadian Indigenous student considering many life choices about your future, Inspire can help. If you need ideas about possible education or career path options specifically for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit folks like you, join Inspire's mentorship program, Rivers to Success. It's free to register, and you'll get plenty of up-to-the-minute information about university, college, and vocational trade schools. Most importantly, again, it's free. It's free. It's free. It's free. It's online, and we have monthly events with prizes. Discover the many potential job and study opportunities that are waiting for you across Turtle Island. Register online now at riverstosuccess.ca. Again, that's riverstosuccess.ca.